today on Against the Grain, William F. Buckley praised it, but so did Dr. King and the Democratic Socialist Michael Harrington. So what then should we make of the Moynihan Report, which continues to stir controversy 50 years after it appeared? I'm C.S. Daniel Geary discusses the turbulent and revealing legacy of the Moynihan Report, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. It had and still has a powerful impact on the way people think and talk about race and inequality in the U.S. 50 years ago, the Moynihan Report was released, and the controversy it generated continues, in a sense, to this day. Daniel Patrick Moynihan was at the time an assistant secretary of labor in the Lyndon Johnson administration. He would go on to become a Harvard professor and a four-term senator from New York. The weird thing about the Moynihan Report is that while many liberals and leftists have embraced it over the years, many diehard conservatives have praised it as well. Why? How could a document about race and inequality and African-American life be read so differently? And how do contemporary racial discourses that point to, for example, a culture of poverty or to colorblindness, how do they relate to the claims made in the Moynihan Report? In other words, what can we learn from, as Daniel Geary writes, the astonishingly wide-ranging and long-running controversy over Moynihan's views of African-American families? Daniel Geary is Mark Pigott Assistant Professor of U.S. History at Trinity College, Dublin. His new book is Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy. When Daniel Geary joined me, I asked him what happened in the arena of civil rights in the U.S. in the year or two before the Moynihan Report was released.
Yeah, this is a crucial period for civil rights in the U.S. because in 1964, you get the passage of the Civil Rights Act, which basically ends the Jim Crow system in the South and declares racial discrimination to be illegal. Moynihan is writing in the wake of that. He also sees on the horizon, although not yet passed, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which enforces the constitutional right of African Americans to vote, mostly in southern states where they'd been denied the right. So Moynihan is writing in the wake of and anticipation of this legislation, and the question he's really asking is, now that we have civil rights legislation, are we going to have true racial equality? And his answer is no, and I think that's what makes the report so significant then and now, that Moynihan had his finger on, he wasn't the only one certainly, but in a high place position in the government, had his finger on this really key issue of how racial equality was to be achieved after the achievement of civil rights legislation. Now, the way Moynihan frames the question and his answer for it, I think is problematic, but I think he's, in one sense at least, asking the right question.
What did the Moynihan Report identify as the main obstacles to full racial equality?
Well, Moynihan made the, I think, fateful decision to focus on the family. The report officially titled The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. In one reading of the report, which has some validity, is that Moynihan was using family to try to highlight a broader range of issues, highlighting basically historic inequalities that went back to slavery, to Jim Crow, to urban migration, to discrimination, and that these were all, you know, cited in the family, and one could see what Moynihan saw as signs of family breakup or instability, namely high rates of female-headed families, high rates of out-of-wedlock births, that one could see this as a result, really a broader social and economic inequality. But at the same time, Moynihan suggested that family instability was the fundamental cause of persistent racial inequality. He uses the term fundamental. So in that sense, there's a different line of argument that by stressing family structure actually is crowding out a broad range of factors that are in fact creating racial inequality. And not only that, but highlighting what Moynihan saw as an issue among African Americans themselves, rather than, say, in a wider system of systemic racism.
I think he used the term tangle of pathology. So he was saying, he was arguing that family structure was at the heart of this?
He was. So by pathology, a term used by Moynihan, another sociologist at the time as well, what Moynihan was talking about there was that he saw family structure as the main cause of a host of social ills plaguing African-American communities, such as, you know, crime, drug addiction, juvenile delinquency, poor educational achievement, and the like. And Moynihan said, you know, at the heart of these problems really is family structure.
And in pointing to family structure, what was he focusing on? You mentioned female-headed families. Was that the key structural element, the key characteristic that he pinned his analysis on?
It was. I mean, Moynihan, his idea of what a family should be is that there should be a male breadwinner, and that women, at least when they had children of young age, should focus primarily on child-rearing responsibilities. He didn't have a problem with women working before or after they had children, but he thought when they had children, they should primarily be at home caring for their children. And so when Moynihan sees African-American families, he sees many that do not conform to this model. And in a sense, Moynihan is suggesting that the inability of African-American men to serve as breadwinners because of unemployment, because of discrimination, that this, to Moynihan, is the key marker of racial inequality.
In bringing up unemployment and discrimination, was he then arguing that some kind of jobs programs or other measures, new measures, needed to be instituted in order to benefit African Americans and to quote, fix these issues, these family structure-related issues?
That's a very good question, and in a sense, I think a complicated one. The simple answer is yes, that Moynihan did hope for expanded jobs programs. He favored New Deal-style public works programs. He favored the government being an employer of last resort. But you won't find that suggestion in the Moynihan report itself, which doesn't contain any policy suggestions, which is part of the reason why it produced confusion later, but also because Moynihan was well aware that President Johnson had already rejected, as part of the War on Poverty, a small direct jobs programs where the government would directly provide jobs to those who were unemployed. So Moynihan may have hoped for that personally, but he also knew that that proposal, in the political context he was operating in, was dead on arrival. And I think we also need, and I think some historians miss this point because they go back and say, you know, wasn't it great that there was this guy, Moynihan, in the presidential administration who realized, you know, the need for jobs creation? It's incredible to imagine a government official today making, you know, a similar kind of suggestion. But let's look at what Moynihan was operating in terms of a political context. And what he was operating in was the civil rights movement had been pushing the need for massive federal investment to improve the lives, not just of African Americans, but of all poor Americans. Massive investment in American cities in particular, as well as in poor rural areas. So in 1963, Whitney Young of the National Urban League had proposed a domestic Marshall Plan, you know, using the analogy of American spending to rebuild Western Europe after World War II. Shortly after the Moynihan Report was released, a Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin unveiled the Freedom Budget, which was a $100 billion program over a period of many years to provide investment, social welfare, and jobs to all those who needed it. And compared to those kinds of far-reaching programs that the civil rights movement pushed, and which were in fact necessary if the U.S. was to achieve true equality, Moynihan's suggestion for, you know, some expanded jobs programs, you know, some system of guaranteed allowances, it looks, you know, looks like weak tea compared to what the civil rights movement said was necessary and what was in fact necessary.
Are we to understand that Moynihan, therefore, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, did not believe that government programs alone could solve a problem that he saw rooted in family structure?
I think he allows for that interpretation because even though he hoped, in a sense, that this would lead to new government programs, he was identifying a problem that, in a sense, he knew was so deeply seated within American society. I mean, structural racism, economic inequality, you know, that mild reforms of the kind that were politically possible and that he personally entertained as a member of the political establishment, were not really going to solve this deep-seated problem. And so that sort of raises this question, well, if government can't really solve this problem, then who can? One possibility would be that the problem was simply an intractable one, which is a possibility Moynihan, in fact, considers at the end of the report. Another possibility, which Moynihan doesn't say himself, but which I think is contained in some of the logic of the report, in which many read into it, is that it would be up to African Americans themselves to solve this problem. And I think by identifying family as the key problem, Moynihan really leads into that interpretation, because many Americans, you know, read the report and were likely to read the report as saying, well, if this is an issue of family structure, an issue of family morality, then what really can the government can do? Isn't it up to African Americans themselves to form stable families? And if that's the route to racial equality, then it puts the onus on African Americans, and particularly on African American leaders, to uplift poor African Americans.
Daniel Geary joins us. He teaches U.S. history at Trinity College Dublin. We were talking about his new book, Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Well, this message of self-help and self-reliance, this sounds very conservative, that, you know, government can only do so much. In fact, government can do very little and should therefore do very little. And we have this community, this African-American community, that should really just pull itself up by its bootstraps. So how did conservatives greet the Moynihan Report in the, you know, the immediate aftermath of its release?
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue wasn't really about self-help at all, because if you look at what civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King or Whitney Young were saying, they actually advocate self-help, but what they're saying is, you know, African Americans can't help themselves unless they have the resources necessary to do so. So when conservatives start to say in 1965, I mean, it's an old argument, but in the context of post-civil rights legislation takes on a new meaning, when they start to say, well, really the answer is racial self-help, what they're actually saying is government either can't do anything, or really what they're saying is it shouldn't do anything. It's a rationalization of inaction on the part of white Americans. And conservatives immediately take up the Moynihan Report in this vein. One notably is William F. Buckley, who is running for mayor in New York City in 1965, and he picks up on some of Moynihan's analysis to make exactly this point. He says, this is not a problem that government can do anything about. It's up to African American leaders to solve this problem, and to individual African Americans themselves. And when he says these things, instead of, you know, denouncing Buckley, Moynihan actually gets behind him, and he even is reportedly says during the mayoral campaign that everything that Buckley said was a plagiarism taken from himself, taken from Moynihan.
So Buckley sees the Moynihan Report as a conservative document, and yet, as you point out in this book, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the prominent socialist Michael Harrington and many other people on the left embraced the report. For what possible reason?
Well, they see the report as arguing something different. They see the report as, in fact, a genuine case for national action, as a blueprint for government following up civil rights legislation and limited war on poverty with a genuine effort to combat poverty in the United States and to try to alleviate structural inequalities. You know, initially, not just King, but other civil rights leaders view the Moynihan Report in hopeful terms, because they think that the presidential administration is finally getting the message that they've been saying for many years now, that some kind of massive redistribution of resources is necessary if true equality is to be brought about. And Moynihan, in fact, does recognize their argument and is speaking to it. So they're not wrong in seeing that aspect of the report.
So then what do we say of a report that can be interpreted in such different ways? I mean, how do we, you know, we like to put things in categories, right? We like to say, well, this is a radical proposal. This is a a liberal document. How then do we assess and assign meaning to the Moynihan Report and what it aimed to do?
I think we have to say that the report is fundamentally ambiguous. It's a report that's produced at a, you know, quite particular moment of conflict. I think liberals such as Moynihan were in a position where they could genuinely understand what was necessary to achieve equality, yet at the same time, you know, weren't willing to go all the way to support these measures. And that produces this kind of ambiguous analysis that can be read in multiple ways. I mean, in some sense, this ambiguity is functional. It serves a function politically, both for the Johnson administration, because it seems to accept the validity of civil rights demands for economic equality without actually, you know, proposing any specific new programs. And it's functional for Moynihan in the sense that he is, you know, he benefits from winning acclaim across the political spectrum. I mean, part of his long-term political appeal is that he is someone who sort of transcends partisan or ideological divisions. And we can already see this with the Moynihan Report, which is really the thing that initially makes him famous, that his desire to transcend these divisions. So in my view, the report is ambiguous. It's neither liberal nor conservative, but in a sense both, or allows for both readings. And this explains a sort of long-term controversy over it, the fact that it can be read in many different ways.
The Moynihan Report was officially titled The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. It was finished in March 1965. It was made public in August 1965. And in November, the Johnson administration, the LBJ administration, disowned the report. Did that hurt Moynihan's career?
Initially, it certainly hurt him. It hurt him on a personal level. But in the long term, no, it didn't hurt his career at all. In fact, Moynihan, he had a PhD from Tufts University in political science and international relations, was a political scientist, he'd had no background really in the study of African Americans or of race in general, at least until he co-authors the book Beyond the Melting Pot with the sociologist Nathan Glaser, that's published in 1963. But prior to 1963, he has no claim to expertise on racial issues. And here he is writing a report on a subject for which he has, you know, little expertise, the Negro family, the title of his report. But in effect, writing that report makes him into an expert on African Americans, what one of his critics called an instant expert on this subject. So in 1966, he's hired by Harvard University as a full professor, where he directs a center on urban studies. He is frequently consulted by the media to try to explain, you know, what's happening with African Americans, particularly in the context of widespread urban rebellions. And then in 1969, Richard Nixon hires Moynihan to be one of his top domestic advisors, all resulting from his fame as the author of the Moynihan Report. Later, of course, he goes on to a long career as senator from the state of New York.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Daniel Geary joins us. He's Mark Pigott, Assistant Professor of U.S. History at Trinity College, Dublin. And he's the author of Radical Ambition, C. Wright Mills, The Left and American Social Thought. We are talking about his new book. It's called Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy. It's a history of the controversy over and the legacy of the 1965 Moynihan Report about African American families. In a chapter of your book, Dan, a chapter titled The Death of White Sociology, you begin by referring to the disproportionate power that white intellectuals held to define African American life. What's important to emphasize here?
Well, in a sense, Moynihan was a perfect example of this, and you know, he's targeted for that, as I was just speaking about. You know, here's a guy who has little academic training, little personal experience with African Americans, and yet, seemingly overnight, he's become one of the leading government and media experts on African American families. We have to remember at this time as well that universities are largely segregated. I mean, there are a precious few African American scholars at the sort of you know, leading American universities, but by and large, African Americans had been excluded. You know, so when you get the Black Power movement in the mid to late 1960s, and when you get the Black Studies movement, which is sort of an intellectual wing of the Black Power movement, you know, they're looking around and seeing just how much power white experts, people like Moynihan, have to define the terms by which African Americans are understood within the larger culture.
And so specifically, what did someone like Stokely Carmichael, leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, what did he say about the Moynihan Report? What was his reaction to it?
It's interesting because Carmichael actually refers to the Moynihan Report in the very speech when he introduces Black Power as the slogan that is now going to be used for SNCC. And what Carmichael says is, well, he says two things. I mean, one, he picks up a critique of the report that had been made by others, that the report blamed the victim. That's the term used by Moynihan's critic, William Ryan, a white civil rights activist. And Carmichael agrees with this. He says, by pointing to alleged deficiencies among African Americans themselves, Moynihan was putting the responsibility on them to correct this problem rather than where it should lay on those who perpetrated inequality in American society. But secondly, Carmichael says, you know, who is Moynihan and who are these government experts to be talking about African-American families? This is not an issue that white leaders really understand, that they know anything about. This is an issue for African-Americans to talk about. And the fact that a group could have the very terms of their family life, something as intimate as that, you know, so casually and, in Carmichael's view, ignorantly discussed by the most powerful men in America, suggested how powerless they were in terms of their ability to define themselves in the wider culture.
Black power advocate Julius Lester had some interesting and provocative and very sharp things to say about the report, didn't he?
Yes, Lester, in his wonderfully titled book, Look Out Whitey, Black Power is Gonna Get Your Mama, has a chapter entitled Bang Bang, Mr. Moynihan. You know, so he's literally, at least rhetorically, not literally, but he's rhetorically calling for Moynihan to be shot. And what Lester is suggesting there is similar to Carmichael, just the illegitimate power that Moynihan has to define African-American lives. And Lester takes particular issue with Moynihan, who he sees as a representative of sort of white liberals. And he sees them as a special problem because, you know, white liberals like Moynihan try to pretend that they are friends of African Americans, that they're friends of the cause of racial equality. They speak this language. But if you look at what they're actually saying, they're enemies. And not only that, but they really haven't taken the time to understand what African American life is like, to actually speak with African Americans themselves. And so, you know, Lester says, until people like Moynihan, you know, come and learn from African Americans, they should really be regarded as enemies.
Yeah, you write in your book that Lester posited that, quote, Moynihans, people like Moynihan, who pretended to ally themselves with African Americans, were more dangerous than open segregationists.
He does say that. He even says, you know, he says, well, if we're going to decide who we're going to shoot first, we should shoot the Moynihans before we start going after the white sheriffs. Now, of course, he doesn't mean that literally, but that suggests just how powerful his critique of white liberalism was. And I think that's, in many ways, characteristic of the Black Power movement.
Now, did some Black Power advocates actually approve of the Moynihan Report? And if so, why?
They did, because in some senses, what Moynihan was saying actually dovetailed with a lot of what at least male Black Power leaders were saying. You know, it was very common among Black Power leaders to talk about the emasculation of African American men and the need to restore male authority within the family. So one example of this is actually in the Nation of Islam. The Nation of Islam's paper, Muhammad Speaks, is very positive on the Moynihan Report. In fact, it, you know, initially says, this report basically just confirms what our leader, Elijah Muhammad, has been saying for decades. You know, he's been talking about the problems with female-headed families and out-of-wedlock births and about the need to restore men as heads of household.
And here, I think, basically what you're pointing to is the fact that Black Power, I mean, by Black Power is a movement, we shouldn't automatically conclude that everybody in that umbrella was on the radical left.
Or they weren't on the radical left necessarily on every issue, and also that there was lots of disagreement within the Black Power movement. Michelle Wallace, who wrote about the Moynihan Report, said that sort of all African Americans wanted to, I can't remember her phrase, but it's something like they wanted to cut out his heart and feed it to dogs. And that's, certainly many African Americans had that negative reaction, but not all did. And some like certain aspects of the report, but dislike others. Some dislike the whole thing, some like the whole thing. But there's quite varied reactions among not just Black Power activists, but African Americans generally to the Moynihan Report. And I think that points to greater diversity within the movement than is sometimes recognized.
So you referred earlier to the push for Black studies. And among the African-American scholars who sought to use sociology to construct competing images of African-Americans, right? Images of African-Americans much different than those offered up by white scholars, was a woman named Joyce Ladner. What should we know about her?
I'm glad you mentioned Ladner, because I think she's an important part of the story, but one that her role in this controversy has too often been neglected. So Ladner grows up in Mississippi. She becomes one of the young leaders of the civil rights movement there, working with SNCC and working with the NAACP. Then she goes to get her PhD in sociology at Washington University in St. Louis. And there, her doctoral advisor is this guy by the name of Lee Rainwater. Rainwater was an ally of Moynihan's. He agreed with Moynihan's view on African-American families. He wrote about what he saw as the pathological culture that African-Americans had. He saw that as resulting from racism, but nevertheless described it as pathological. And Rainwater was actually the principal defender of Moynihan, at least within academic circles, along with his graduate student, wrote the first book on the Moynihan Report controversy called The Moynihan Report and Politics of Controversy. That's in 1967. But Ladner comes to entirely different views from both her advisor, Rainwater, and from Moynihan. To Ladner, the tradition of sociology that white scholars like Moynihan and Rainwater had propounded was one that offered a too pejorative a view of African-American communities, of African-American families, that had sources of cultural strength that were not acknowledged, that had different cultural values when it came to family, and that African-American families should really be understood as part of a coherent cultural system with its own values, certain values which were superior to what she saw as the sort of white middle class model, which with its nuclear family units, that she found African American family structure more based on superior values of cooperation. So Ladner is sort of one of the key people who challenges this view that African American families and African American culture more generally should be seen as pathological.
Daniel Geary is his name. He teaches U.S. history at Trinity College Dublin. We are talking about his new book, Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy, published by University of Pennsylvania Press. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Dan about his really interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Daniel Geary is Mark Pigott, Assistant Professor of U.S. History at Trinity College Dublin. His interests include political ideologies and movements, the development of American ideas about race and ethnicity, and the history of the social sciences and their role in shaping public discourse and public policy. A while ago, I interviewed Daniel about his book, Radical Ambition. That's a book about the influential social critic C. Wright Mills. And today we are talking about a new book of his called Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy. And that refers to the report put out by Daniel Patrick Moynihan in 1965. It was officially titled The Negro Family and the Case for National Action. So Joyce Ladner, who you were talking about before the break, she edited this landmark collection of Black sociologists' work. It was called The Death of White Sociology, published in 1973. When did Black sociology emerge, and what kind of impact do you think it had?
Well, it emerges in the late 1960s, and this collection, you know, in the early 1970s shows that it's, you know, sort of, let's say, at its apex in the early 1970s. And I think it had a very significant influence on the discipline of sociology. I mean, so Black sociology is part of the broader Black studies movement. Now, of course, sociology had a long tradition of providing academic analysis of race relations in the United States. So it's not an accident that many African-American scholars went into sociology. But Black sociology suggested not that one needed to be African-American in order to understand African-American life, but that one at least needed to understand African-American perspectives, that one couldn't be someone like Moynihan, who had little personal experience of African-Americans and little, you know, interest in how they understood their own lives, but one needed to understand things from the Black perspective, I suppose.
Scholars often like to represent their work as objective. Did Black sociologists think that scholarship on African-American life could or should be objective?
Some did. You know, some said that the sort of the white domination of the field and the previous inability to incorporate African-American perspectives that had made the field lacking in objectivity. But many Black sociologists said that objectivity was neither possible nor necessarily desirable. I think one says, you know, this is, if you're an African-American writing about what it's like to be an African-American, then this is obviously an issue of profound importance to your own life and the prospects of those that you know. So this is not something that you can be or would want to be, you know, wholly objective about. And they make the same point for, you know, scholars like Moynihan. They say he, you know, Moynihan was not offering an objective view of African-American families, but rather he's standing from a certain standpoint in society, one of white power and white privilege, and that shapes, you know, the view that he gives about African-American families.
And the standpoint of many white intellectuals, and you make this clear in your book, is that they compared, or I should say they evaluated, African-American families in terms of whether or not they attained certain standards which seem to be often or always white middle-class standards and norms. Elaborate on this and tell us what the Black sociologists and Black studies scholars had to say about it.
Well, I think from the what someone like Moynihan would say about that is Moynihan would not accept that this was a white, you know, middle-class standard for him. You know, the idea of the male breadwinner family was a universal model that everybody should adopt. But from the perspective of those Black sociologists who are criticizing Moynihan, you know, they suggest that this is not a universal standard, that this is, as you suggested, a white middle-class standard. There's a way in which they combine, you know, sort of race and class in a certain way because, you know, it sort of leaves out the white lower class or the Black middle class, for example, but that we'll just leave that to aside for a moment and say, from their perspective, they say this is a white middle-class standard and it doesn't really capture African-American families that need to be understood in their own terms, not for their failure to attain another model, but what is the family model that they actually have, and what are its strengths as well as its weaknesses.
So part of the project of this book is to see how the Moynihan Report, which was released in 1965, how it has been read over the decades, in fact, up till the present moment. And let's talk about William Julius Wilson, the very prominent sociologist. You write that he resuscitated the Moynihan Report in a certain political way in the 1980s. How did he read the report?
So Wilson is very much writing against the Black sociologists that we have just been discussing. Wilson wants to revive the view that African-American culture and family life is pathological, and that this pathology results from deeper inequalities within American society. So to that extent, Wilson chooses in his 1987 book, The Truly Disadvantaged, he chooses to say that he is, in his own words, following the footsteps of Moynihan. Wilson is a liberal. I mean, in fact, he's a social democrat. He favors universal social programs for employment and other means of social welfare. And he sees the Moynihan Report basically as a liberal document. I think Wilson, you know, there's a lot that's good in his work. He really does effectively, you know, identify a lot of the social inequality in our society. He does a much better job than Moynihan, in fact, in explaining this and particularly explaining it in the context of the effects of deindustrialization on the job prospects for African Americans. But I think Wilson made a mistake in adopting the Moynihan Report and wrapping himself in that mantle. He did so at a time when the Moynihan Report was widely celebrated by conservatives, and I think Wilson thought he could say to those conservatives, well, if you really care about African-American families, you have to support the kinds of social democratic programs that I do. But his argument didn't really work, and I think, moreover, the way that he used the Moynihan Report suggests Wilson's really dominant focus on African-American men, that by pointing to some of the same things that Moynihan did, you know, rates of female-headed families, that Wilson was suggesting that the problem really was with African-American men and the solution was to provide African-American men employment. This suggested that, though he didn't explicitly say so, but that he supported the same kind of family model that Moynihan did, the male breadwinner model. But it also, I think, blinded him to other ways of tackling inequality, such as providing higher wages to women who are single mothers.
Dan Geary is professor of U.S. history at Trinity College Dublin. We are talking about his book, Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy. We have a link to that book and to Dan's faculty page at Trinity College Dublin on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain. Well, you know, Barack Obama was influenced by the sociologist William Julius Wilson. So what stance has Obama taken on the Moynihan Report?
Obama has been a supporter of the Moynihan Report. He has, you know, his book, The Audacity of Hope, he specifically mentions the Moynihan Report by name. He says that those who criticize the report, referring, you know, partly to the black sociologist we referred to earlier, you know, were unfair and misguided when they criticized Moynihan. And I think, you know, one of the programs that Obama has supported in recent years is this program called My Brother's Keeper, which is designed to provide mentors to young men of color. And it suggests that he adopts the Moynihan Report's analysis in that it's family structure that's the problem, and particularly African-American men, other men, of young men of color, the men that we need to worry about, and that the solution might come through the presence of role models. Now, there's nothing wrong in itself with providing role models to those who need them, but I think the problem with stressing that kind of approach is that it eclipses the need for what's really needed to combat inequality, which is, you know, a massive redistribution of resources in our society. So I think by supporting the Moynihan Report, you know, Obama is preferring individualistic solutions to racial inequality.
Would you say that Obama is part of the pathologist's camp, the you know, the group of folks who kind of want to stress the pathology within African-American communities and families?
He certainly is. I mean, he's actually even, you know, he uses that language himself. He, you know, he uses the term pathology. So I think there's no doubt that he's in the pathologist camp and that he has followed Wilson in that regard.
And the emphasis on pathology, I mean, that makes me think of the concept of culture of poverty. Those three words have been thrown around a lot in the last many years. Tell us about that concept and to what extent we should link it to the Moynihan Report.
Yeah, I mean, Moynihan didn't use the concept himself in the report or the language, but it is closely linked as an idea. I mean, culture of poverty, That term was used by the anthropologist Oscar Lewis, who first used it to refer to Mexican peasants, who he studies anthropological work, and then later used it to refer to Puerto Ricans, both in Puerto Rico and Puerto Rican migrants to the mainland, United States. And what Lewis meant by the term was similar to what Moynihan had in mind. In fact, Lewis identified, you know, female-headed families as part of the culture of poverty, along with a series of other factors like alcoholism and an orientation toward the present rather than toward the future. But the key similarity, I think, is that Lewis saw the culture of poverty as something that was self-perpetuating and, in that sense, deep-rooted. Now, like Moynihan, like the Moynihan report, the phrase culture of poverty or the analysis could lead in many different political directions. Now, Lewis himself was a socialist, and he supported the Cuban Revolution, among other things, and thought that organized action by the poor would be the surest way to get rid of the culture of poverty, and he certainly supported social democratic programs to do so as well. But of course, the analysis also had strong conservative implications or strong conservative uses, you know, where it allowed conservatives to say, well, the problem is a cultural problem. It's not a political problem. It's not a social problem. It's not a problem to do with exploitation or, you know, power relations in our society. The problem is flawed culture among the poor themselves. And therefore, it's up to the poor to address this culture if, you know, they hope to succeed better.
Dan, in your book, you trace the conservative, among other things, you trace the conservative interpretation and conservative appropriation of the 1965 Moynihan Report. And I'd like to point to one episode that you bring up, which occurred on the 30th anniversary of the publication of the report. That's 1995. William Bennett, former education secretary under Ronald Reagan, he praised the Moynihan Report. On what grounds?
Well, Bennett says in 1995, he says that the Moynihan Report was a great document because it pointed to what the real problem was, which was a lack of moral values, a lack of family values. So, you know, Bennett was speaking the language of movement conservatism about the need to restore family values. And he was also saying that the problem was not racism. The problem was a lack of family values. Now, it is incredible, and Bennett then also says, well, there's nothing that government can do to restore family values. This is up to individuals and communities to do. Now, it's incredible that he makes that statement because Bennett, of course, had recently been the drug czar under the first President Bush. In that role, you know, he presided over the mass incarceration of African Americans, which, you know, if you wanted to point to one thing that was damaging African American families and communities in particular, you'd point to mass incarceration. So here, the engineer of mass incarceration is saying there's nothing that government can do, but what he's missing is what government was doing, what he himself was doing. And I think that's a, you know, we haven't talked about it, but that's a flaw in the way that the Moynihan Report sets up the problem. It says, well, here's a problem. Can the government do something? Can it not do something about it? Well, what about the things that government was doing that was, in fact, reinforcing racial inequality? I mean, there were a number of things the government was doing at the time Moynihan was writing that he missed, such as redlining practices, which the federal government basically enforced racial segregation in housing and prevented most African Americans from being able to get a decent mortgage to buy a home. And here's Bennett, you know, framing things in the same term and then allowing to be ignored or missed the role that the government was actually playing in reinforcing racial inequality, and which had, of course, a direct effect on African-American families. This is something, you know, that has been not Bennett's role particularly, but the importance of mass incarceration as an issue affecting African-American families has been pointed to by Ta-Nehisi Coates in his recent cover story in The Atlantic, in which he takes up the Moynihan Report as a sort of framing device to tackle that whole question.
What about the question, the politics of colorblindness? Does that have its origins to some extent in the debate over the controversy around the Moynihan Report?
I think the Moynihan Report argument offers a kind of a necessary complement to ideas of colorblindness because people are not blind. Everybody can tell that in the United States today there are vast disparities, vast inequalities, and that these inequalities map onto racial divisions. So if you want to argue that the United States has become a colorblind society, you know, that its laws are colorblind and that racial prejudice no longer exists, then you need an explanation for why obvious inequalities persist. And the Moynihan Report offers that an explanation that can be used in that way. It was not necessarily the way Moynihan intended it, but it can be used in that way because it says, well, inequalities persist because of the flawed culture that many African Americans themselves have and their failure to adopt the correct family values. So it explains why they remain unequal and why it's their responsibility, you know, not a problem with structural racism, because in this view, the U.S. has become a colorblind society.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Daniel Geary's new book is Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy. So, Dan, you write that even today, the Moynihan Report, this is 50 years on, remains a political litmus test. For what?
Well, I think it helps reveal political divisions. I mean, the report is still hated by many on the left, and it has its supporters among conservatives as well as among liberals. Although if you look at the way they read the report, you can tell the difference in their political divisions there. So, I mean, there have been numerous mentions of the report this year. Perhaps one of the most interesting ones was when the New York City Police Commissioner, Bill Bratton, you know, announced, this is at the end of August, he announced that over the weekend he'd read the Moynihan Report and that this explained a recent crime wave in New York City. I don't know what he does on the weekend, but apparently he goes and reads 50-year-old government reports. And then Mayor de Blasio heard what Bratton had said about the Moynihan Report, and de Blasio said, you know, that's nonsense. He said, this document is 50 years old. It has an antiquated idea about family, antiquated ideas about race. Some city council people attacked Bratton for using a report that they called racist. So it speaks to the passion that this report can still generate and the divisions that, you know, that you can see. I mean, in fact, Mayor de Blasio and the police commissioner, they are coming from different backgrounds. They probably have different views of things. They've tried to be allies, but here was an example where you could see the real differences between them, you know, how they were reading this 50-year-old document.
We've been talking a lot about how other people read and thought about the Moynihan Report, and I want to ask about your opinion, and particularly your opinion of this notion that African Americans, their position in today's society, can be explained by family structure. What's your sense of that?
Well, I think the main thing that I would say, and the thing that I really learned from studying the Moynihan Report and the controversy over it, is that this is the wrong way to start a conversation, you know, about racial inequality in our society. If we want to talk about inequality, you know, we should talk about things like taxes, housing, education, and where our society chooses to assign its resources. Also about the long history of racism in this country. I mean, it's sort of incredible that people in 1964, 1965, you know, immediately said, okay, well, we've passed the civil rights legislation, so, you know, everything's equal now. I think we need to look at the history here. Of course, we should study African-American families. We should study, you know, all families from an academic perspective. We should also understand how families are affected by inequality, you know, and what role family structure plays in that. But I think this is just the wrong way to go about having this debate. I mean, we have to remember, nobody asked Moynihan to write a report on the African-American family. The question that Moynihan was addressing really was the question of racial inequality, why it was likely to persist after the civil rights era. I think the report has continued to be used so often because it provides different competing answers to that question, but it addresses that question. But if that's a question we want to ask, you know, why does racial inequality persist in our society, and why do other forms of inequality, class inequality, gender inequality persist, I don't think we should start that discussion with a discussion of family structure.
And you're right, and it's understandable given the way you've described the Moynihan Report today that the left today has little to gain by appealing to the Moynihan Report. Now, you're obviously on the left, so why write a book about a document that you really don't see has very much use to the left today?
Well, I think it's important to understand the Moynihan Report, to understand the kinds of ways that Americans have gone about discussing inequality in our society in the past 50 years, the kinds of strategies that have been pursued, throughout the political spectrum, but also, it is an argument with people like William Julius Wilson and others on the left who've tried to recover, some kind of strong argument for government action from the report and have celebrated as doing that. And I think that that's, both misguided in terms of reading into the report a single meaning that it doesn't, in my view, actually have, but also a flawed political strategy, because we see how easily these arguments are used by conservatives and how effectively conservatives have used it. So I think we should certainly understand the report, understand the arguments that it makes, understand the history of which it's a part. But I would be happy if we treated the document as effectively dead as offering any kind of blueprint for what we should be doing to solve our problems today.
Daniel Geary, Mark Pigott, Assistant Professor of U.S. History at Trinity College Dublin. We've been talking about his new book, Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy, published by University of Pennsylvania Press. Dan, congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.